As you very nicely said, I think, you know, particularly in America, we think that influence is bad. It's not a four-letter word, but it's pretty close.
Yeah.
You know, there's this myth of the nonconformist. We're all different. We're all separate. We're all completely original and different from everybody else. And that's just not true at the end of the day. And not only is it not true, but influence just isn't as bad as we think. You know, imagine for a moment that you couldn't pick a car mechanic or what restaurant to try or what movie to see by talking to anybody. You had to figure out yourself every restaurant you'd ever try, every book you'd ever read, every movie you'd ever see. You had to do all the work to figure it out yourself. You had to read all the reviews and the information and sift through it, you know, page through the book, figure out if you wanted to buy it. Life would be really difficult. And so, you know, so many times others help us make better decisions and also faster decisions. We read online reviews to help us pick something. We talk to our friends to help us figure out what to do. That's influence, and that's definitely not a bad thing.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before the show starts, I want to tell you about a few quick things. As you've probably heard me mention on a few previous episodes, we're right around the corner from the launch of our new book, Unmistakable: Why Only Is Better Than Best. We've been sharing pictures of it on the newsletter and on social media. So if you haven't done it yet, you can actually download the introduction to the book for free at unmistakablecreative.com/book. And if you want to get access to all the pre-launch emails where we'll be announcing pre-order bonuses and everything else in between, you can sign up at unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter. And speaking of writing a book, one of the most important things that enabled me to get the book done was taking control of email. And if you've read any of my writing on Medium, you know that I put a lot of systems in place to avoid wasting time on email, to avoid distractions of all sorts. But at some point, I knew I'd have to actually deal with the email. And I knew that if I just went through and deleted everything, I would miss something. And there were too many emails to go through one at a time. And so I finally learned a secret to reaching inbox zero and getting my sanity back. And it's called Sanebox, which is the sponsor of today's episode, and I can't recommend it enough. It sorts through your email and moves all the trivial stuff into a different folder, so the only messages in your inbox are the ones that you actually want to see. And not only does it remove the junk so you can focus on messages that matter, there's a feature that's called a black hole. So you can move an email into a folder that you'll never hear from the sender again. It's awesome. And since we could all use a bit more organization in our email life, we actually worked out a really great deal for Unmistakable Creative listeners. Visit sanebox.com/creative today, and they'll throw in an extra $25 credit on top of the two-week free trial. And you don't even have to enter your credit card information unless you decide to buy. So there's really nothing to lose. Check it out. It could be, make a big difference in your productivity. And if you love the black hole feature and reaching inbox zero as much as I do, I think you'll be blown away by the product. Again, that's sanebox.com/creative. And our other sponsor for today's show is HostGator. And if you have aspirations yourself to do something like write a book, the easiest way to get started, believe it or not, is with a blog and a website. Seth Godin even recently said in an interview, the best way to be where you want to be a year from now and 10 years from now is to do something today that you'll be glad you did. And today's sponsor, HostGator, can help you to get started with 30% off all their hosting packages, reliable 24/7 support, and an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy. So visit HostGator.com/creative to sign up and use the promo code creative for 30% off at checkout. Jonah, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So, you know, I have known about your story for quite some time. I've actually read your other book, Contagious, and your new book literally showed up on my desk and you know, literally showed up on my doorstep. And then I got an email from your publisher saying, do you want to talk to Jonah? I was like, yeah, absolutely. You know, we've had one of your colleagues, Adam Grant, here as well. So it is really, really cool to have you here. And since we are talking about the subject of social influence, which is the subject of your newest book, I thought it would be really interesting to open with this question. Which, you know, we've opened a few shows with, and it's been really eye-opening. What social group were you a part of in high school, and how did that impact the choices that you ended up making with your life and your career?
That's a fun question. So I went to a math, science, and computer science magnet high school. And so had also went to one of those for middle school, one of those things you have to take a test. And if you do well enough on the test, you get in. And so I was surrounded by some people that were really, really good at one thing. So they were either really, really good at math. We had some people that, you know, like took the international math exam or some of the top scoring people in the world. We had some people that were really good at computer science. Some people who, you know, today were on the early wave of a lot of companies that have now been really successful. And so a bunch of people that were really good at something. I was not that good at any of those things. I was okay enough at each of them to get into the school, but was definitely nowhere near the best. But what was neat is that program. So it was the Montgomery Blair Magnet Program in Silver Spring, Maryland. And that program was situated in a larger school. So I think something like 100 kids each year were part of the magnet program, but then another 500 or 600 were part of the regular program. And so what was really neat about it is you got to take these advanced classes, but you were also surrounded by lots of regular people. And so you got to play sports and do all the other things that people normally get to do in high school. So I was kind of a geek, but not the chief geek by any way, shape, or form. I was not smart enough to be that. But I think my own identity came out of trying to blend those multiple groups. So, you know, I love playing sports. I was on the soccer team. Then I wrestled. I was on the cross country team and was never the best at anything, but was okay at a number of things. And so I think my proudest moment in high school was I think my senior year, I won the all-around student award. And why I really liked that is, again, I wasn't great at anything, but I felt like I was able to be okay at a few things, touch a few different groups, you know, be involved with student government, and connect a lot of these things in an interesting way. And I think that's always, you know, taking a step back, that's always a great way to be creative. You know, people talk about bringing together disparate things or disparate influences, and I think that's really a great way to come up with new ideas. You know, it's always good to be really deep in something and to know a lot about one area, but particularly if you can bring together multiple areas or different perspectives, that's often a good way to be creative and come up with new ideas.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned multiple times that you weren't particularly good at any one thing, but you're okay at a lot of things, and you're surrounded by these really sort of high achiever, ambitious people. And I'm asking this for very personal reasons, because I spend my days interviewing people who are sort of at the upper echelon. And when you're around people like this on a regular basis, how do you manage to get what you can from being around those people, like get the best by being surrounded by people who are at higher levels than you, by not getting into this trap of comparing yourself to them and wondering why you're not at the level that they're at? You know, I mean, what was your experience with that, being surrounded by so many smart people?
Yeah, I mean, social comparisons are a powerful tool. They can motivate us, as you noted, but they can also demotivate us. You know, if we're golfers and we spend our time, I don't know, comparing ourselves to the top golfer, what Tiger Woods used to be, we're going to be pretty disappointed. Yeah. You know, if we compare ourselves all the time to the entrepreneur that's knocking it out of the park, you know, every given year, you know, most of the companies most of us start are not going to be the next Uber or the next Facebook. And so I think it's important to learn from greatness and learn from people that are really successful. But also not expect that you need to be like them on every level, because sometimes, you know, you look at those folks' lives and they've really given up a huge amount to be where they are. And that's something that some of us are willing to do. And it's not something that I think others of us are willing to do. But, you know, one thing I often do is I try to figure out what makes someone good at something. So when I started public speaking, for example, a few years ago when Contagious came out, I'd always been an academic speaker, always spoke academic conferences and, you know, presenting research. But I started being a keynote speaker at, you know, larger events. So, you know, the association of this or the council of that or, you know, an event that had 8,000 people. And had never really done that before. And so I was trying to figure out, you know, how should I do that? And one thing I did was I tried to look around and figure out how other people did it. You know, I watched the people who came on stage before me who are much better at it than I was, and tried to figure out, well, when does the audience laugh? You know, when do they seem to be having a good time? When do you notice them engage versus when do you notice them tuning out? And I think, you know, sometimes particularly in America, we think copying is bad. We think imitating is bad. You know, we think we have to come up with everything by ourselves. But really great folks that are good at anything, they learn from others. And so I think it's a really smart way to just look around and say, great, you know, if I have this opportunity to be close to greatness, what's making this person or this organization so successful? How can I try to reverse engineer it and use that to be more successful myself?
All right. So walk me through the journey of how you go from, you know, being part of this magnet high school where you're kind of this jack of all trades student to how you end up doing the work that you're doing as a professor, because you're kind of this interesting blend of like author, social scientist slash educator. And I'm curious, you know, how that whole high school experience impacted the choices you've made and then, you know, kind of what the journey was from there to where you are today.
So I'll give you the medium length version. If you if you want longer, you can ask. But so went to this high school. We had to do like a senior research project. I did one on urban hydrology, which I bet most of your listeners have no idea what it is. Neither did I at the time. It basically means measuring streams. So literally taking like a big pole, measuring stream depth across a cross section of a stream, and figuring out how the way that the land is used in the watershed affects the stream geometry. Okay, fantastic. Really sort of nerdy science stuff. Went to college thinking I would do that type of thing. So I thought I would be an environmental engineer. Thought I was going to major in that type of topic, sort of science, technology, and society. Then in one of my first classes, my first semester, we were reading about how the way we build buildings affects the way we raise our children. And so the idea very simply is when we all live in small houses, we can see our kids play in the front yard, so we let them play, they hang out with the neighbors, they become good friends. When we start building these huge buildings, we can no longer see our kids playing in the front yard, so we don't let them out as much, so they're less likely to become friends with the neighbors, and it affects how they grow up. And I thought this idea was really interesting, and I asked the professor, hey, you know, where could I learn more about this? And he said, oh, you should check out social psychology. There's a class on social psychology. And so I had already started doing a little bit of research kind of in the area, being a research assistant with someone who was a doctoral student in psychology at the time, started taking social psychology and found it really interesting. And had always still assumed I would go into business, had always assumed I'd get an MBA, but I started kind of studying the questions that I've ended up studying today. So was interested in why things catch on, why products succeed, how social influence works, how it drives fads and fashions to catch on and die out. At the time, you know, a couple of years into my college time, a book came out called The Tipping Point that many of us know and love. Loved that book, thought it was really interesting, thought it wasn't super research-based, but really interesting stories. So I kind of dug in more into the research. Malcolm Gladwell was nice enough to suggest some other books for me to read and started doing research with a guy at Stanford named Chip Heath, who is now part of the Heath brothers, who have written Made to Stick and Switch and Decisive and a number of other books, and started doing research on how ideas catch on, how things stick and spread. And the rest is kind of history. So from there, did a PhD. From a PhD, started to be a faculty member at Wharton and sort of had done a bunch of this research on social influence, word of mouth, how things catch on. Was teaching a class on it at the Wharton School called Contagious, How Products, Ideas, and Behaviors Catch On. And would always have people that couldn't take the class, but would ask, oh, you know, I couldn't make it this time or sold out already. You know, is there any way I could get the material from the class? And I would often say, oh, great. You know, here's some papers that we read. And they would always say, those are really boring academic papers. Don't you have anything more interesting? And I would sort of say, no, you know, I didn't. There were some, you know, social media books out there, but those were pretty applied and they weren't always science based. Yeah. And there were some psychology books out there, but they weren't always applied enough. And so that's one way I started writing Contagious. And that's how I started on this whole journey.
Interesting. Okay. So, you know, like you have this moment in your life that it seems to all go back to, which is that moment when you have this spark that, hey, I'm interested in this thing while I'm in this class. From the perspective of being an educator now and being a teacher in a setting like the one that you were in, what do you notice are the common patterns in your students when moments like that occur? And why do you think we often miss moments like that in our lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's making sure to have the time and the space to ask an interesting question, even if you don't know the answer. And so I think the way schools are now, particularly being in a business school myself, but also the way that students are now, how they're much more career focused than they used to be, everybody sort of wants to make sure that everything they're learning will help them on their career path tomorrow. You know, everyone's studying violin because they think it'll get them into college. Everyone's making sure to do an extra internship and to be the captain of the this class or the that class because they know it'll have a certain impact. But I think the challenge is sometimes discovering something new is not about having the answer right away. It's about asking an interesting question that you really don't know the answer to. So I got started studying word of mouth, for example, with a colleague of mine. You know, I would see in the Wall Street Journal that on page A2 or A3, there was always a list of the 5 most read and the 5 most shared Wall Street Journal articles. And this was back in, like, you know, 2004 probably, or 2004, before even the internet was a huge deal. You know, this was the stuff that people were sharing. And I was wondering why. Why are some of these articles shared and others aren't? And I had no idea. You know, I really wasn't sure. You know, I would look to the literature and there were some theories out there, but with a great collaborator, Catherine Milkman, who's now at Wharton also, you know, we started digging into it and we explored it a little bit, and we didn't always know the answer. And so I think sometimes there's a desire to pick things that will get you to an answer quickly, but sometimes the really exciting stuff is just about asking a question, asking an interesting question, and seeing where the data and the results take you.
Okay, so I want to spend a bit of our time getting your thoughts on education and you know, the current educational system, because, you know, Adam and I had a pretty lengthy chat about this, and anytime I get to talk with a professor, I'm always curious on what their perspectives are on education in its current form, what they think about the future of education, like what is it going to look like, and, you know, I mean, there's so many sort of alternatives now to college, and so I'm so curious to hear kind of what you think is right, what you think is wrong, and what you think the future will look like.
That's a big question and an important question. I mean, you know, certainly at Wharton and other places have seen a lot of interest in these sort of online courses, mm-hmm. And leveraging whether it be MOOCs or online modules or education to help people learn. And I think what I like about that is I think it begins to think a little bit more about what is most effective for different students and different types of material. You know, the classroom is a great place to learn and can be a great place to engage with one's peers, but I'm not necessarily sure it's the best place to learn everything. You know, it is introduction to chemistry, for example, is being in a 600-person lecture hall at 9 a.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the most effective way to learn intro to organic chemistry or whatever it is. And I'm not an organic chemistry professor, by the way, so I don't have that answer. But my guess is, you know, sections are really useful for people to ask questions, but being in that lecture hall may not be the most effective way for all students to learn. And so I think where you know, I don't think MOOCs are an end-all be-all. I don't think online education is an end-all be-all. But I do think the exciting part is beginning to think about what methods of diffusing information are best. You know, might certain material be better online because people can come back to it and they can pause it and they can, you know, listen to it again. And then they can go on and they can meet with a TA or, you know, a professor or a section leader and begin to ask questions. So I think that's quite exciting. I also think, you know, in business education, I spent a year a few years ago at something called Cornell Tech, which is in New York City. So your listeners may be familiar with this, but Cornell started a new tech campus in New York City with the goal of blending business and technology education, really sort of, you know, educating the tech leaders of tomorrow. And, you know, Wharton's a great school, been around for a long time, does well in the business school rankings, but it's a big ship and it turns very slowly. And change doesn't necessarily happen quickly there always. Cornell Tech is built on a really nimble sort of startup platform, sort of a maker platform. You know, we'll try something one year, you know, whether it works or not, we'll try something else the next year. And they're really thinking about, you know, how do we make sure tech entrepreneurs are not just deep on the technology side, but also deep on the business and the innovation side? How can we pair people who are good at technology with people that are good at business? And I think some of these new programs that may not be as prominent at the moment or as sort of have as long a history, but are really trying to think differently about education, or at least think a little bit differently about education, have a powerful opportunity to upend the traditional model.
Okay, so I have one other question about this. You know, I heard my friend Eric Wall, who's a graffiti artist, say something in a talk. He said, you know, standardization stigmatizes being wrong. And yet a good amount of our school system is rooted in standardization. And I'm curious kind of what you think we're going to do to change that, or, you know, what does the future look like when we have to consider the fact that maybe standardization isn't the best model for how to teach people? How do we cater to the individual, I guess, is really the question.
Yeah, and I think we have to be careful here, right? Yeah. Because again, there's this notion that difference is better, that everyone is a unique, special snowflake, and everyone needs something completely different. And, you know, forget classes, forget material. Everyone learn whatever they want. Yeah. There's some value there. Obviously, you know, I did an individually designed major in college, so I put together a major that blended social psychology, marketing, and sociology that really gave me the basis to study what I study today. So I didn't do a traditional major. That said, I didn't invent courses. I picked an existing set of courses. I just combined them in a different way. Or similarly, you know, if you want to be even a graffiti artist, for example, I imagine there's a set of skills that everyone needs to learn. And then there are a set of skills beyond that that you need to build on. And so I think, you know, rather than saying, oh, let's throw away everything, we need complete difference, I think it's really about, and actually, you know, I talk about this a little bit in the new book, Invisible Influence, but the value of being similar and different, the value of combining existing things in new ways, or the value of picking a few things that are identical to everybody else, but one thing that's different. And I think, you know, everyone is not completely different. There are some different ways of learning. There are different types of people who learn different sorts of ways. But I think having a more flexible than just a one-size-fits-all model can incorporate some of that variance or heterogeneity and give a broader set of people a chance to learn better.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Sanebox. Because all of us could use a bit more organization in our email life, we've worked out a great deal for Unmistakable Creative listeners. If you visit sanebox.com/creative today, you'll get an extra $25 credit on top of the 2-week free trial. You don't even have to enter your credit card information unless you decide to buy. So there's really nothing to lose. It will help you to take control of your inbox, reach inbox zero, and more importantly, gain your sanity back so that email isn't driving you crazy and taking up so much of your time so you can actually work on things that matter. Again, you can visit sanebox.com/creative to learn more. Today's episode is also sponsored by FreshBooks. So FreshBooks has created this really easy-to-use cloud accounting software that helps you to fly through all the annoying admin and paperwork tasks that you don't have time for. It's what I've always used when I've invoiced clients when doing freelance work. And don't let the word accounting scare you. It's actually built specifically for creative people who don't like dealing with numbers. You can create a professional-looking invoice in just 30 seconds. You can add your logo and your color scheme to it so the voice reflects your brand. And your clients can pay you online, which actually improves how quickly you get paid. FreshBooks users are known to get paid 5 times faster. You can also track your time, your expenses, and you can even integrate it with your online banking system. And they can even show you whether or not a client has looked at the invoice you've emailed, and you can actually automatically send late payment reminders. And they're offering a free month of Unmistakable Creative listeners right now. And you don't even need a credit card for the trial. So go to freshbooks.com/creative and enter the Unmistakable Creative podcast in the How Did You Hear About Us section. This episode of the podcast is also sponsored by TrueCar. So there's something about TrueCar a lot of people don't know, and it's that using TrueCar can help you to buy a used car as well. If you haven't downloaded the app yet, it makes the entire car buying process really seamless. With just the push of a few buttons, you can set the make, the model, the features, and you'll get back search results. You'll be able to see the pictures of the car you want in whatever color. You can see the interior. You can see the exterior. You can see the price you'll pay, and you'll get to see the discount that you'll receive. And not only that, you can actually use it to connect with a local certified dealer. There have been over 11,000 TrueCar certified dealers nationwide, and more than 2 million cars have been sold using TrueCar. Not only that, TrueCar users save an average of $3,279 off of the manufacturer's suggested retail price. So if you haven't checked it out yet, whether you're ready to buy a new car or a used car, visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app to enjoy a better car buying experience. And remember that some features aren't available in all states. All right, well, let's shift gears a bit. Let's actually get into the book. I mean, I would love to do a deep dive into what these invisible influences are, how they shape our lives, and of course, you know, what we can do with that information. So let's start with what they are.
Sure. And so really what the book is all about in a nutshell is we think we make our own choices, and very simply, we're wrong. whether we think about the breakfast cereal we bought, the radio station we listened to, or big stuff like what career to pursue or what person to marry, we think we make those decisions. Our preferences, our likes and dislikes, all of that drives what we do. And very simply, we're wrong. Other people make those decisions for us. Sometimes we do the same thing as someone else. We see our neighbor bought a new car, we're more likely to buy something similar. We see a lot of people like a restaurant, we're more likely to try it. At the same time, sometimes we do something different. We're at a restaurant for dinner with a group of our peers. Someone else orders something. Well, we skip ordering that. We actually choose a different item than we were going to order because we don't want to be the same as them. And other times, others motivate us. Did a bunch of research showing that others are a really powerful motivating force to help us do better, whether it's exercise more or work harder at work. Other times, others can demotivate us. They can provide a standard that's too tough to reach, and so we get demotivated and give up. And so really, the book is all about these different types or flavors of influence, when others lead us to be the same, when they lead us to be different, when they motivate us, when they demotivate us. And how we can use all this exciting science to be happier and healthier, both at home and at work.
Okay. So it's interesting because I think the moment you tell somebody you don't make your own decisions, especially like a person who's incredibly ambitious and driven, that probably makes them cringe just the slightest bit. The idea made me cringe until, I remember reading it said, be open-minded. I was like, all right, I'm going to go into this with an open mind. Because I think when we think about something like influence, right, and the idea that we're susceptible to something that another person tells us or the environment that we're in, we naturally think, somebody is trying to manipulate us into doing something that we don't want to do. And I'm curious how this becomes something more positive. I mean, you mentioned that, you can use this to be a much happier person in your life. So I guess I'd like to look at it from a few different contexts. One is, in the context of sort of entrepreneurial efforts. Another is in social context, social situations, relationships with people. And then maybe, for parents listening, kind of how it plays out with their kids.
Sure. And just, to take the higher level question to start, as you very nicely said, I think, particularly in America, we think that influence is bad. It's not a four-letter word, but it's pretty close. Yeah. There's this myth of the nonconformist. We're all different. We're all separate. We're all completely original and different from everybody else. And that's just not true at the end of the day. And not only is it not true, but influence just isn't as bad as we think. Imagine for a moment that you couldn't pick a car mechanic or what restaurant to try or what movie to see by talking to anybody. You had to figure out yourself every restaurant you'd ever try, every book you'd ever read, every movie you'd ever see. You had to do all the work to figure it out yourself. You had to read all the reviews and the information and sift through it, page through the book, figure out if you wanted to buy it. Life would be really difficult. So many times others help us make better decisions and also faster decisions. We read online reviews to help us pick something. We talk to our friends to help us figure out what to do. That's influence, and that's definitely not a bad thing. I don't think any of us would say that's bad to listen to our friends to figure out what to wear to a formal event or, the right question to ask in an interview, talking to someone who's been successful, looking to other entrepreneurs who have succeeded to figure out how we should lead our own businesses or organizations. That's not a bad thing. That's a smart thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think to me, it's really about first noticing influence. We don't want to admit it happens to us. If you ask people sometimes do see influence. They see other people driving the same cars. They see kids listening to the same music. In fact, if you look around, there's only one place that people never see influence, and that is themselves. We are entirely unwilling to admit that we're actually influenced. And part of it's because it happens non-consciously. It happens below our awareness. Often we're not aware that others affect our behavior, but they do. And so first, being aware of that, and second, knowing how to use it. The more we're aware of influence and understand it, we can take advantage of its upsides and we can avoid its downsides.
All right, let's talk about taking advantage of its upsides, because the moment you started saying that, my mind went to, okay, how can I use the concepts that you have outlined, not only to make the stories we tell here on Unmistakable Creative more effective and influential, but just as a writer, speaker, and somebody who puts my thoughts out into the world, how do I leverage that, and how do I tap into the power of influence?
Yeah, so just a simple example. So You know, imagine you're negotiating. So you're, whether it's a house or a car or a contract with a client, really anything at all. Some scientists looked at what made people successful negotiators. They looked at hundreds of negotiations, trying to figure out, you know, what did they have in common. And they found that one trick led negotiators to be five times as successful. Five times more likely to reach an outcome when it looked like it would be difficult for that to happen. That trick, very simply, was subtly, and subtle is important, but subtly mimicking the behavior of others. So if the two of us are sitting in a negotiation and you crossed your legs, I would do the same. If you tilted your head to the side slightly, I would do the same. I wouldn't imitate everything that you do, but like a chameleon, I'd subtly change my behavior to fit my environment, whether it's the mannerisms, whether it's language, whatever it may be. Negotiators who did that were five times as likely to reach an outcome. And it's not just negotiators. Other researchers looked at a sales context that find that waiters or waitresses who mimic patrons' tips. So someone's order, they say, you know, I'd like the Caesar salad with chicken, dressing on the side, and a Diet Coke. And you say, okay, you'd like a Caesar salad with chicken, dressing on the side, with Coke. Take those same words compared to, you know, saying, okay, you'd like a Diet Coke and a Caesar salad dressing outside, mixing up the words. Same words, same order, 70% higher tips. And so the idea very simply is don't just listen to people, though listening is important. Emulate them. Subtly mimicking the mannerisms, the behavior, the language of others deepens trust. It increases liking, and it facilitates social interactions. If you look at daters, for example, people on a first date, those whose language naturally matches more, well, they're more likely to go on a second date. And so the idea very simply is, you know, being similar to someone makes them feel a kinship. If you and I, for example, found out that we had the same birthday or we went to the same high school, we'd feel like we had a little bit more in common. And so we'd be more likely to trust each other, like each other, and have better interactions. And so that's just one way, again, taking advantage of the tools of influence that we can make ourselves more successful.
What surprised you that you didn't know in the research process for all of this? Like what were the things that seemed that are incredibly contrarian that probably people have misperceptions about?
You know, so we did some research on the how others motivate us or demotivate us. When are others sort of a powerful motivating force, or might they hurt our ability to succeed? And I used to be a soccer coach. I used to coach AYSO U12 boys, and what would notice as a coach that halftime came around. We were a pretty good team. Halftime came around, but at the end of the game, we were more likely to win if we were actually losing at halftime. When we were winning, somehow we figured out a way to lose, but if we were losing, somehow we figured out a way to win. And so I wondered, well, was that just my team or my bad coaching skills, or is there something deeper there? So with a colleague of mine, you know, we looked at tens of thousands of NBA as well as college basketball games. We looked at the score at halftime and the score of the end of the game. And what we found was that in general, being ahead was a good thing. So teams that are ahead and the more they are ahead at halftime are more likely to win. Not surprisingly, you know, being up by a point or two, for example, 2 points, let's say, increases your likelihood of winning by 6 to 8%. So if you're a betting person, you're betting on a basketball game, pick the team that's ahead rather than the team that's behind, except in one place. And that was that teams that were behind, but just by a little bit, teams that were down by one were actually more likely to win than teams that were ahead by one. So not only are they worse teams on average, because in average, you know, teams that are losing tend to be worse teams, but they're behind. They have to score more points to win. And yet they did it. They not only did it a little bit, they did it significantly more. They came back and were more likely to win the game. And the reason very simply, as we've been talking a little bit about, is motivation. When you're behind by just a little bit, that the proverbial, you know, you're so close you can almost taste it. Others are a powerful motivating force to get us to work harder. In basketball, they led teams to come back and win. In other contexts, they've led people to run faster and bike harder and work harder and save more energy. And so one way to motivate ourselves isn't just to do it by ourselves. I think we have this notion that, oh, you know, we've got to do it all by ourselves. I want to lose weight, I've got to do it by myself. I want to exercise more, I've got to do it by myself. Peers are a much more powerful way to make sure we achieve our own goals. Again, they're not a bad thing. They can actually be helpful. had a friend who was trying to lose weight. He was trying to lose 15 pounds for about 3 years, never seemed to do it. And then finally, he figured out a way to do it. He challenged a friend of his to see who could lose 15 pounds the fastest. And sure enough, those pounds came right off. And so that was a case again where, you know, someone else, social influence, let him do something he couldn't do otherwise.
All right, so there's one area that really struck me from the book that I remembered. It was about brands who specifically went out of their way to pay people not to be associated with their brands. So I'm really curious, kind of, you know, what are the implications of all of that? I mean, to give people some context, let's explain it to them. But I mean, what are the implications of all of that for us, our work, and kind of in our lives?
Sure. So there's this notion that we buy the things we buy for what they do. We buy a car for the way it drives. We buy clothes because we like the way they fit or their price. But a lot of what we buy and what we do is driven by what it signals. And so I'll give you the sort of example you were mentioning and a couple others as well, because I think it's a really interesting case. So a few years ago, your listeners may remember Snooki from the Jersey Shore. She was the short one that sort of was colored like a parking cone and said very nasty things every so often. But she walked down to the mailbox, opened her mailbox, and found a free Gucci handbag. And she was really excited, of course, because not only was there a Gucci handbag, but she actually didn't pay for this Gucci handbag. Someone had sent her a free Gucci handbag. Now, that by itself is not very surprising. We all know that brands do product placement, maybe hoping that if someone like Snooki is using their bag, other people will be more likely to use it as well because they'll see her on television or in the magazines. But it wasn't actually that Gucci sent Snooki a bag. It was actually one of Gucci's competitors. So one of Gucci's competitors had paid money to buy a Gucci bag and send it to Snooki for free. Why would a competitor send Snooki a Gucci bag? And it actually wasn't her only. One of her peers on the Jersey Shore, Mike the Situation Sorrentino, who was known for his abs, he had like the six-pack abs or whatever, he also got a letter. This was from Abercrombie & Fitch offering to pay him money. But it wasn't Abercrombie & Fitch offering to pay him to wear their clothes. He was actually being paid not to wear their clothes. So why would Abercrombie & Fitch offer to pay him money not to wear their clothes? Turns out in both of these examples, the key insight was that we buy things not only for what they do, but also for what they mean. So in the case of the Gucci handbag, you know, Snooki's, the person who sent it to her was hoping, look, if people like Snooki are carrying Gucci bags, then the target market for Gucci handbags, the folks that have the money to buy it, might not want to buy it anymore. Or if people like Mike the Situation Sorrentino are wearing Abercrombie and Fitch, people might not want to do it anymore. Because, again, we don't just buy things for what they do, but also what they mean. What do they signal or communicate about us? And it's not just funny things like, handbags or clothes. Same thing happens with politics. So I was recently working with an organization that wanted to get clean energy to catch on among conservatives. And so they went around to ask conservatives, you know, do you support clean energy? If so, why? If not, why not? And they found out that clean energy should be something conservatives like. When you look at the data, clean energy helps reduce our reliance on foreign oil, something that conservatives should like because it increases national security. It also makes government smaller, something conservatives should like. But conservatives don't support it. They don't support wind power. They don't support solar power. And if you ask them why, one politician said it really nicely. He said, well, you know, it seems like Al Gore supports clean energy. And if Al Gore supports clean energy, it's probably not for me. And the idea very simply is, look, you know, if someone like that is doing it, probably someone like me is not going to do it. And so it's not just about what the issue is, the upsides or downsides. It's what it communicates to others, what it signals or what it means.
Well, I'm actually glad you brought up politics because that was going to be sort of where I wanted to go with this next. I mean, being in an election year, I'm really kind of curious what the implications of all your research are for what is going on currently with the election, and like what is your perspective on it based on all of this research?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about this election is it's a great example of things like party or things like meaning over policy. People aren't voting necessarily based on who has the best ideas. They're voting because they're angry. They're fired up. And they think that certain candidates stand for certain things, whether or not their policies actually stand for those things. You know, you talk to Trump supporters, they really have no idea what he's going to do, but they know that he's angry and they're angry, and that he stands for being anti-establishment, and they don't like the establishment. You know, you talk to people who support Bernie Sanders, different, totally different political party, but basically the same thing. You know, they don't necessarily agree with all his policies, but he feels like a Washington outsider, at least compared to Clinton. And so that's why a lot of young people support him. And so I think, you know, we're really seeing a case where influence as well as marketing and understanding human behavior is driving voters. You know, everybody said, oh, there's no way Trump is going to be successful. There's no way he could do this without, you know, being on message and clear and exactly this and that and everything the political establishment has been for, you know, 50, if not 100 years. And yet he's ignored all those things and been quite successful. So I think if we learn one thing from this election season, it's that it's not that people are weird or that, you know, politics is a domain unlike any other or this year is an anomaly. It's about we got to understand how people behave. Why do they do the things that they do? How does emotion, for example, drive sharing? We did a bunch of work a few years ago showing that, you know, the more angry people are, the more likely they are to share. This is exactly what Trump has harnessed well this year, you know, taking high arousal emotions like anger, anxiety, and using them to drive transmission. It's not just that positive emotions are shared. It's not just that policies are shared. It's not just, you know, the person with the most money wins. It's the person who knows how to craft contagious messages, how to influence others, and how to use that to build a platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. When you're talking about Trump, you know, I remember my business partner and I were talking. He said, you know, like, as he's gotten closer and closer to where we're at now, his craziness has toned down a bit. I haven't been keeping up with it, but like you haven't heard him mention something like the Trump wall. But then my business partner said, he's like, think about it. That was brilliant from a PR perspective because it generated so much publicity because of how ridiculous it was.
Exactly. And I think, you know, we've done some research on controversy, for example. So how controversy drives conversation. Not surprisingly, you know, a little bit of controversy goes a long way. It's, you know, you don't want to be extremely controversial. You don't want to be something that, you know, everyone has a really, really strong view about. But, you know, building a wall is something that's a little bit controversial, gets some attention, and, you know, gets him bigger exposure than he would otherwise. And so in some sense, some of these ideas are marketing 101, but he's harnessing them really effectively.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Design Crowd. So I know I've talked to you extensively over the last several weeks in these ads about why design is so critically important to your business. You know, no matter how much people tell you that we don't judge a book by its cover, if you land on a website that looks really ugly or you land on graphics that look really ugly, somehow you're just kind of repulsed by them. And it's really hard to take somebody seriously if the design of the work that they're doing doesn't look good. Fortunately, however, design doesn't need to be this crazy, expensive, inaccessible thing. And that's where a service like Design Crowd comes in, because they make the equivalent of an entire creative team accessible to a price that's at a price that's affordable to just about anybody. And here's how it works. Basically, whatever your project is, whether it's a website design, whether it's a flyer, whether it's an ebook, whether it's a t-shirt or poster or even a business card or a logo, you go to Design Crowd and you submit your project, and then you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 people from around the world. And if you like one of the designs that you get, you can actually approve payment, and then you'll receive all of the files for that design. If you don't like what you get, you can actually go back to the crowd and ask for more, or you can actually ask for your money back. And because you're an unmistakable creative listener, you get $100 off your first design project. So there's really no incentive not to try it out. You really should check it out. Go to designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative for $100 off your first purchase. Our other sponsor for today's show, of course, is HostGator, since they've been the sponsor for every single episode that you have heard this year. And as I've encouraged you in many episodes previously, if you're not ready to start a website, if you're not ready to start a blog, you have no idea what you're going to do, do something really simple. And that is to just buy a domain name, buy yourname.com, because that alone could be the start of a lot of bigger things. And you know, more and more people are being required to have some sort of web presence when they want to apply to jobs or do anything else or having a place to showcase their work. And so HostGator can help you get started with 30% off all their hosting packages. Just visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Let's look at the flip side of this, because I think, you know, like you said, we kind of see influence as a bad thing. Like, we don't want to be persuaded to buy shit we don't need. You know, it's that whole Fight Club thing, things that you own you. How do we how do we not become susceptible to influence in the moments that we don't want to, given what you know about all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think one question we can ask ourselves is do we like something or are we doing it because we think other people like that thing? You know, at the end of the day, why are we buying something? And, you know, the challenge I think is often influence is non-conscious. We're not aware it occurs. You know, you ask people why they bought something, they'll give you an answer. Oh, I bought it because it was on sale. I bought it because I liked, the color that it was, but they don't realize, that they actually bought it because they saw lots of other people, wearing something similar. We did some research on baby names, for example. So we looked at over 100 years of baby names, over 200 million births, basically the popularity of every name in the United States from 1900 until now. And we found some predictable patterns. You can actually predict what names are going to be popular in the future by looking at what names are popular now. But it's not just that popular names become more popular, unpopular names become less popular. It's about the similarity between names. So we found, for example, if Lisa's a popular name this year, then other names that begin with that L sound, so you know, Larry and Lucinda and other names that start with that L sound are more likely to be popular in the future. Even hurricanes, you know, like take Hurricane Katrina, for example. You think no one would name their child Katrina after Hurricane Katrina. But baby names, there was a 10% increase in names that began with K after the hurricane. And that wasn't just people naming their kid Katrina, but they were naming their kids names like Kathy and Kim and other names that began with that sound because they heard that sound more. Merely hearing the name Katrina more often made it sound more familiar, made people like the sounds that were part of it, and made them like other similar things more, even without being aware of it. You know, if you ask someone, no one would say, oh, I named my child because Hurricane Katrina happened and I heard the name and I liked K names. They'd say, oh, no, my uncle had this name or my aunt had this name or, you know, a friend growing up had this name, so I gave this other name. And so we're often not aware it occurs. That said, doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Just by understanding it, we can harness its power.
All right. So a few more final questions for you. This is one that I've been asking just because it's been really interesting to see. And I'm curious if you were to recommend any book, music, piece of music or piece of art to our listeners that has profoundly impacted your life, what would it be?
I only get one. Only get one?
You can you're more than welcome to share three.
Oh, okay. You know, there are many, but one of my favorites is a book called A Matter of Taste, that book is all about baby names, but studied from a scientific perspective and using baby names to understand culture more generally. It's written by this guy, a famous sociologist. His last name is Lieberson, Stanley Lieberson. Really amazing, interesting book, but causes you to look at the world differently than you might otherwise. So a great book that really changed the way I thought about things.
Awesome. Well, I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
You know, I think you have to be willing to be a little bit different, but not too different. You know, I think you have to stand for something, have a passion, have a purpose, follow those things, do something you love, you know, not be exactly the same as everybody else, yet not be completely different. There's an ideal point in there. People often call it being optimally distinct or similar and different at the same time. And, you know, building similar things and using them to be a little bit different is a great way to be creative and to be more successful.
Awesome. Well, this has been really, really insightful. So where can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah. So best place is just my website, just Jonah Berger, JonahBerger.com. There's a bunch of free resources there. Help them apply the science from the books. And they can also find me at J1Berger on Twitter.
Awesome. Well, like I said, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your insights with our listeners. This has been fascinating.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
My grandmother taught me, gave me some very early stage seeds of the whole concept of being in service, in making a contribution to the highest interest of others and the power of those relationships. She didn't just sweep floors and run a register and take orders for film development. She got to know these people and they got to know her, and she forged relationships that lasted many, many, many years. And when it came time for her to retire, in the days before her last day and her retirement, she had customers coming in and giving her gifts and giving her flowers and thanking her for her service and her contribution. And that all began with her attitude and her outlook and her view of the importance of relationships and bringing your best self to them.
Michelle Reyna joins us to talk about relationships and trust.